The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
You're going to cook the cranberry sauce?
It's already made.
Oh.
All right,
I'll heat it up.
All right, well, this is Thanksgiving Day in the Lane house, and I asked everyone in my family to sit around the table and
Simon, get over here.
Say happy Thanksgiving to the listeners of the podcast.
Happy Thanksgiving. Don't eat no turkeys.
Simon,
these
do you want to say something? this week's guest is Harvey Kay. We have a book that we're going to publish by him, and we talk about American exceptionalism.
Yeah, that sounds fun. That's so, my brother Ben. I don't
so
think
in any case, it's a Thanksgiving special. We're all sitting at the table recording on this laptop instead of my usual microphone. So enjoy this Zero Books podcast with Harvey Kay on the American left.
All right.
Oh, you wanted us to add something, which is if you're British...
Or not American. You won't be celebrating Thanksgiving today.
That's true. Should have a turkey sandwich anyway, even if you're listening to this in the UK.
You probably have to go to work.
Maybe you can go get a turkey sandwich from a little sandwich store.
Okay.
Or don't eat turkey.
You have to eat turkeys. Thanksgiving Day.
Turkeys are people too.
No, they're not.
Oh, that's terrible to consider. Harvey J. Kay is currently the director of the Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He is the author of The Fight for Four Freedoms, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, Why Do Ruling Classes Fear History, and many other books, including one that we're currently negotiating to publish through Zero Books. That book is tentatively entitled Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. Harvey Kay, thanks for coming on to the Zero Books podcast.
Oh, this is great. I've been really looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm really excited to be publishing your book, and I sent you a bunch of sample questions, but before I get to that, I have to ask you, like, kind of in a fanish way, you are friendly with Bill Moyers. What is he like when he's not on TV? Can I ask you that kind of question?
Yeah, no, and in fact, I can tell you that something that really impressed me at the times where, like, even in emails, he is very humorous. And sometimes in a kind of silly but still decidedly intellectual way, it was either this past year, it was sometime during the past 2 years, we had an exchange going for some time having to do with American geography. I'm never going to be able to reproduce the humor in it, but it came down to this idea, you know, that he was from Texas, so that how would he possibly know what the upper Midwest was like? So he was constantly making utterly ridiculous but truly meaningful kinds of jokes about American geography. And so I can tell you, as one of the best sense of humors I have ever encountered, and maybe because he's sort of that sort of Texas, Oklahoma kind of guy that they grow up on, a kind of down-to-earth kind of humor. So, I can tell you that's the thing that has most impressed me about him. And in fact, Doug, you can edit this out if you want, but my first encounter with him. Have I ever told you about my first encounter with him? Oh, okay. Yeah, this actually, it definitely could stay in. So it was October of 2004, and I was delivering the final manuscript of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America to Hill and Wang in New York, which is part of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And my editor and I had already become good friends. And when I got, I delivered it, sent it by mail, but I came to New York so we could have lunch and celebrate the delivery. And while I was there, he said, by the way, before we go to lunch, I want you to spend an hour with the marketing and publicity people as if you were going on a radio show, because they're going to develop spin for the sake of marketing the book. I said, great. So we went down and he left me with these three people, marketing, publicity, and I'm forgetting what the other person was. And we did a really interesting 1 hour. And at the end of the hour, my editor, Thomas Levien, who's now at Harvard University Press as a senior executive editor, he came in to collect me so we could go to lunch. And I stood up, and I think it was the head of publicity said to me, "Harvey, listen, you got a really nice bunch of names for blurbing the book, but who would you like us to approach that you don't yet know or, you know, don't know well?" And it just popped into my head. I said, Bill Moyers. And had to do with the fact that years before, when I co-edited a volume entitled The American Radical, his team had asked for multiple copies because they were working possibly on a documentary on American progressives and radicals. Anyhow, I said it and I let it go. I didn't even think about it again. And then, let's see, October, November, December, January, it was like 6 months later, 5 months at least, I had stayed out of the university for a day because I had to go to the dentist. And I stopped by at night to check my mail. And as I walked by my office, I thought, yeah, should I look to see if I have any messages on the answering machine? And I opened the door and light on the old days when there were lights on answering machines. And I ran this tape. I pressed the tape. And I swear to you, there was a 1 minute tape and it sounded like this. Professor K, this is Bill Moyers of Public Television in New York. And I'm calling to tell you that I'm filing a legal suit against you in court. And I thought, what the fuck? You know, what am I going to do? What, did I plagiarize somebody? What am I doing here? And then he said, the reason I'm filing the suit against you is you've given me, you know, he said, I've been up 3 nights in a row reading the galleys of your book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. I have been politically depressed, you know, ever since we lost the 2004 elections, meaning when Bush beat Kerry. And your book was the first bit of hope, or the first time I felt a bit of hope in what we can do. And then he said, I've been up till, and by the way, the tape was at 4 a.m. He had stayed up late into the night for a few nights reading the book because he had a throat infection. And he found my book stimulating, and he went on and on and on. I mean, by the way, I mean, it was like, no one could have. So wait, he said, and so I'm going to sue you because you've given me insomnia and bouts of euphoria. And then he closed by saying, I'll see you in court. And I got off the phone. I said, holy cow. And I grabbed my cell phone because that was my office phone. And I called my editor and I put the phone to the tape. And I said, Thomas, listen to this. And Thomas says at the end, he goes, it worked. He heard me say Bill Moyers. So he went to one of the senior vice presidents of Frost, Jass & Giroux, a woman named Elizabeth Sifton, a big figure in the publishing industry in New York. And she was good friends with Bill Moyers. In fact, she and her husband had dinner with Bill and his wife that same week. And she handed him the galleys to the book. And the rest is we went 3 years communicating by phone and email and never actually met. And then I won't go into the fuller story, but I ended up on the show 3 times and we became good friends. And yeah, so. And through him, I met some really remarkable people like Norman Lear, the television producer, and some others.
Yeah. Norman Lear is great, too. What I was going to say about Bill Moyers is that, you know, as a wannabe Marxist, and that's what I call myself quite often, I sort of feel as though I ought not to be as charmed by Bill Moyers as I am. Like, you know, he's pretty he doesn't represent the most radical parts of the American tradition to me. But
I'll give you a chance to defend him
because I'm going to defend him first. Okay. This is what I'm going to say. Is
fair enough.
I would just say that because he's been put into Walter Cronkite position. In other words, he's a recognizable face. He comes into your living room when he has someone on like Noam Chomsky. He'll ask him to say what he means when he says that that he believes in Cartesian common sense. He'll say, what do you mean by Cartesian? Even though, you know, Bill Moyers knows, right? He's a good broadcaster. He's very good at connecting to just everybody. And because of that, he doesn't seem special enough to be a socialist, right? It doesn't seem different enough to be part of the most radical side. But I think he's had so many different people on that really are radicals. That he then facilitates in connecting to everyday people.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I mean, without question, Bill is a social democrat. I don't think there's any question. I mean, he began his in quotes, political career in the Johnson administration, Kennedy administration, then Johnson administration, as the deputy director of the Peace Corps. And he came into the Johnson administration basically, you know, with the dream of civil rights and the Great Society. And I don't think there's any question about his politics on being liberal left, but liberal left with a real streak of populism that, you know, I don't think, and by the way, and this will maybe segue into a lot of other things, but I don't think enough Americans appreciate. I don't think enough coastal Americans. How's that? I mean, I grew up in New York, so I can.
Oh, you're hitting me below the belt now, coastal Americans.
Yeah, but I still think of myself as a New Yorker, or at least, you know, New York and New Jersey boy.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I've learned, and somebody once said to me, you know, you're really lucky you've been out here in Wisconsin all these years because this way you can be taken seriously by the heartland, you know, that kind of thing. But it is the case that Bill in some ways is sort of, you know, maybe I shouldn't build it into his biography too much, but it is the case that the Southwest, of the classic Southwest of Texas, Oklahoma, heading west from there, even throwing in a bit of Arkansas and Louisiana, there was a real populism that existed there that also then melded into what we would call a kind of socialism. And the revivals of that we think of in, you know, these Christian evangelical revivals took place throughout Kansas and even, you know, Oklahoma and Texas and beyond in populist and then socialist form. Farmers and agricultural workers and miners and railway workers would turn out in droves with their families for weekends of what in the Northeast was called Chautauquas, actually. They'd hear lectures, they'd hear, you know, there was like a rally and a university of the weekend at the same time. And Bill comes from this, you know, sort of rural and also working class background, decidedly working class background. I mean, his family probably was rooted in dirt farming, and then eventually his father was driving a truck. I mean, and he never left that behind, and especially in light of what's gone on these past 40 years with, you know, the new right and then the sort of neoliberal liberals and corporate capitalism and its class war from above. I mean, I know over the years that Bill has generally moved left. And there's a couple of articles around the time of his retirement from television written by Peter Dreyer, who's a progressive radical professor in Southern California. And he, this piece I'm thinking of, I think it was in the Progressive magazine. And he said, just think about the people that Bill Moyers brought on to TV that no one else would have brought on. And he included me in their number. And it's absolutely true. I mean, I did some other shows. I did C-SPAN shows and MSNBC. But the fact is that Bill Moyers' show, as far as I'm concerned, was one of the greatest moments of my life, those three times that I was on. And I feel like it was a turning point in my career. And anyhow.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Joseph Campbell is the academic who I think of as being truly catapulted by Bill Moyers in a way that was the most dramatic. Maybe I'm overestimating Moyers' impact there, but
well, that's a good point. I mean, I'm not a fan of Joseph Campbell, but I do understand what it meant to Bill, and I don't want to go into that right now. But I know what it meant to him.
It did mean a lot to him, but also he had a way of taking people who from the academy or intellectuals of different types and catapulting them into the mainstream and making them relevant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's a real loss for our culture that, and I'm don't vomit when I say this too much, okay? Don't vomit too much. But there was a real loss for our culture in the absence of firing line with Bill Buckley, and then decidedly all the more for our own purposes, the retirement of Bill Moyers from television a couple of years ago. So in fact, I think it was last year or a couple of years. I'm losing track of time.
Right.
And then it was 2 years ago. And then the website went on for another year or so. And now it remains as an archive, which I use regularly. But I mean, it is the case that we've lost that conversation. And that conversation allowed a place for the likes of the left. And for example, Bill Buckley had Cornel West on when Cornel West, you know, was black socialist.
Right.
And there were those kinds of things, I guess. Now, you know, go on to cable TV, you know, you go on to even MSNBC, and they've adopted all the neocons who are anti-Trumpsters now. And, you know, so it's like you're watching, you know, the neocon revival.
Yeah, well, the whole media landscape is different now, too. I mean, back in the days of Firing Line, there was a center for American politics, and it was television, and it was just a few networks. And people wanted to sit there and listen to conversations at length. And now that there's so many different channels competing for our attention, everything is very clipped and short. And I mean, there are exceptions, but, and also everything's down to the niche. So there really isn't, I mean, there are people who are doing podcasts, not me, but there are other people doing podcasts or doing other kinds of programs on the internet or maybe on some cable channel somewhere that may be just as talented and insightful as Bill Moyers, but they never have the position he did.
Yeah, because as they say, the times have changed. But the other thing about Bill is that he actually read. I don't want to go on into my own autobiography in relation to Bill Moyers, but he really read what I did. And so when we talked, in fact, one of the beauties with Bill, and this is not fair, but I often had the feeling that Bill and I were really on the same wavelength, even though we were good, 15 years apart in age, but really on the same wavelength. And so that when he asked me a question, I often had the feeling that he wanted to say the answer himself, you know? And that's why I had this, and that's why I understood just how progressive, even approaching radical, he was. I do this all the time. Why do I blank on that Texas populist voice all the time? Bill in some ways is kind of just maybe a less joking version of that. I mean, it's populism. He loves the agrarian populist moment. I often think that if you asked him to, there were two things. First of all, I think what really connected us was the fact that he just adores Thomas Paine. And he adores Thomas Paine for his radicalism, and he adores Thomas Paine because he felt that Paine was the first great American journalist. Okay. And then that's the other thing. But when you look at the trajectory of American radical politics, it's the populist movement that really, really speaks to him. And again, but there again, that connects to the fact that he's from that area of Texas, Oklahoma, where the populists were truly small P progressive and were more than willing to pursue socialist initiatives.
Would you say, because one of the main points of your book that you turned into Us is that American leftists can or should be proud of the history of America or the history of the left in America?
Well, I think
let me get to the question part.
Okay.
So would you say that that populist tradition that informed Bill Moyers is central to that left tradition that you think we should be proud of?
Oh yeah, yeah. The populists of the late 19th century, absolutely. And one of the things that we fail to consider on the left, this has been my story for as long as I've been trying to write about American politics and history. And I'll just mention, I wasn't trained as an Americanist; I was trained as a Latin Americanist, and I worked on British Marxism and socialism for a while by way of works on the British Marxist historians like E.P. Thompson. But when I came into American political writing, which had to do especially with answering the new right and their use and abuse of history, one of the books I wrote was titled The Powers of the Past. It was a look at Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan as the champions of this use and abuse of the past, and in their case, especially the abuse of the past, and the effort to suppress the memory of what, in our case at least, truly made America great, excuse the expression. And what it was is that there is, it came out of previous historical studies about other countries. I was astonished at this persistent and reverberating American radical tradition that in some ways we all carry around with us, so that there are words out of our past that tap into us, not simply in a kind of, not as a nationalism thing, as fucking Trump would say, but as a patriotic kind of thing, because American patriotism at its heart is a very radical idea, grounded in the arguments of Thomas Paine. we have it in our power to begin the world over again. I mean, how much more radical can you get than that? And that's long before Karl Marx would have said it. We know Jefferson's sins. So we know what the legacy is, as ugly as it is beautiful. But the fact is, he wrote that line. You know, we hold these truths. You know, all men are created equal. This right to pursue life, liberty, and this fundamental idea of equality, which, by the way, even liberals fail to appreciate, obviously, because life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness demands a kind of material equality in order for it to work. And I wrote once about how the fight for 15 is basically a fight for the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So, and these great words, or even the first three words of the preamble, for all of the failings of the framers of the Constitution and their hostility to fundamental democracy, they put into it. In fact, one of the most conservative members of that group wrote, "We the People." Why? Because he wanted the people to transcend the rights of states individually. These are radical ideas. And what makes America radical fundamentally is the American promise. And that I believe in, and I will not be dissuaded from that. I mean, I think after all these years of arguing for it, it'd be hard to dissuade me. But that promise afforded an imperative. And it's an imperative that we feel that imperative. And by the way, the tragic side of that imperative is the likes of the 2016 election, where millions of people turned out to vote for Trump. Why? Did they love Trump? Well, some did, obviously. But a lot of others just wanted to punch in the nose the neoliberals who had been doing them in for the past 40 years. Why do we assume on the left that just because we forgot so much that working people, rural and urban, forgot what the Clintons did to them during the 1990s, if you get drift?
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing. I think we should come back to this question about why people voted for Trump, but in a maybe slightly different context. But
okay. In
a couple of weeks, I'm going to be called upon, and this is my own doing, to defend, the way I framed it originally was to defend Enlightenment values or liberal modern values against a friend of mine who's, also a socialist, who feels as though those liberal modern values, the values around, say, for instance, free speech or equality before the law, are inherently contradictory because of the way they were constructed on top of a contradictory material practice of capitalism. That you're you'll have your opportunity here. I'm feeling like, hey, I've got Harvey on the line. Maybe I can get a couple of, he'll give me some notes. I can cheat on this test. So, he wants to say that these values themselves are inherently contradictory. Going back to Kant, that there's just internal conflict around the goal of equality, say, that the aim of equality in and of itself kind of is unstable, that it will self-destruct because it's flying in the face not only of the reality that we're not equal, but also it relies upon an outside force, a state, to be a leveler, and that kind of thing. I actually haven't heard all of his arguments yet, so I shouldn't really.
Well, that's great. So I'd like him to, can I tell you something? I've got this image in my head, Doug, if you want to do it. Eugene Debs, you with me?
Yeah.
So Eugene Debs was arrested in 1917, 18 for sedition because he spoke out against World War I in the draft. Okay. And in court, defended himself and stood before the jury and the assembled folk and basically called into the courtroom. I love this speech. It's one of the greatest speeches in American history. Calls into the courtroom everyone from like Payne and Jefferson to Lincoln and others to talk about the imperative of dissent, to talk about the meaning of freedom, the struggle for democracy. You know, he really brings them all into the courtroom alongside him. When he does it, you can almost see them as he's speaking these words, as we're reading these words. Well, tell Debs that freedom of speech, okay? Give me a fucking break, okay? Or how about Frederick Douglass? I mean, Frederick Douglass, who at first was a Garrisonian, who was willing to buy the idea, better to secede, to break up the Union than to continue under a constitution of slavery. but learned perhaps a new way of reading the Constitution, that you read the Constitution not in terms of those who stood those who authored it. This is Douglass's approach ultimately, but rather what does the text say? And the text never says slavery. Moreover, it says we the people. I mean, there's nothing in there that Douglass is unable to embrace and turn in a radical direction. I mean, it isn't nothing simple. And the fact if freedom of speech is being used, as in the Citizens United case or whatever the hell it is, to use against us in terms of real equality, that's the failing in us. And that's the fact that for 40 years we've allowed, you know, the left to be defined by neoliberals, if you like. I mean, you know, the fault lies, you know, there was that line, my father used to love the comic strip Pogo years ago. And, you know, what is it? We have met the enemy and it is us, something like that. And seriously speaking, you know, all these 40 years, the Republicans, the right, you know, the corporate entities, they do exactly what we expect them to do. Okay. Well, what do we do? And we obviously screwed up. And by the way, and you know, I could talk about that in a whole evening if you want. I mean,
well, maybe I need you on my side when I do this debate. I feel as though that your impassioned defense of free speech, as good as it is, may not ultimately help me. Let me tell you why that. Let me just say
I'm not an absolutist on these things.
I understand
on free speech. Okay,
yeah, right. Me neither. But well, I probably am closer. Here's what I'm worried about, and this is like the thing that I think I have to really try to overcome when I talk to Varn. And by the way, this is being done in the service really of trying to hold on to these values. It's like debating them is a way to work out how we can hold on to them.
Sure.
One of the difficulties, let's just say around free speech, is that the notion of the rational individual was historically, like say in Mill's case, tied to certain cultural assumptions, but not
right,
just
and
like
class position
and class position. It. Right. So there were whole peoples that he thought simply weren't developed enough morally, culturally, or economically to be rational. And the question is,
I got to write myself a note to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah. The question is, to what degree does the concept of free speech require for there to be some sort of irrational other to juxtapose your own project against or your own culture against?
Yeah, you're getting awfully philosophical on
that. I know.
Let me put it this way. I'm gonna pull this whole thing back into history. Okay.
Okay, you do that.
And I stand on this with, I'll stand with FDR, and I can tell you that FDR in a speech made it very clear he would rather trust the people who work in a factory than the financiers who underwrite the operation. He had more confidence that they could deliberate, okay, and come up with a, and I'm sure he had in mind a democratic and progressive kind of direction for the or decision making than he could for those, you know, who have money in their pockets all the time. And I heard John Nichols, my friend John Nichols of The Nation magazine, a fellow of Wisconsin, I came and spoke to my students, and he spoke to them and he said, you know, I'd much rather have 100 people of diverse classes and backgrounds deliberate something than I would a crew or a cohort sitting in offices of power. In other words, I'm not going to deal in the abstract with the question of reason. I just can't. I have to deal with the world in which I live. And here's what I would say, okay? I believe that we carry within us – let me go back to my Gramscian roots. How's that? I mean, Gramsci talked about the mass of people, and it's not my word, working people as, you know, as like most of us, filled with contradictory consciousness, right? That is, you know, we carry around a hell of a lot of thoughts in our brains. You know, some of them may be good and some of them may be evil, whatever else. The fact is that maybe the role of intellectuals and the role of political leaders is to cultivate the good, the smart, the class consciousness, if you like, out of that contradictory consciousness. But what have we seen? Again, I go back for 40 years. What have we seen of politics on the left? Okay, leftists talk to each other. Liberals basically, you know, who the hell knows what they're doing? They're just trying to get the same money into their coffers for campaigns as conservatives have. I mean, our task is to start sounding like we actually, number one, understand who we are. and we remember who we are, and we are able basically to tap into that, you know, if you like to call, use Gramsci's term, contradictory consciousness, and remind people of who they are, because they carry around within them a hell of a lot of deep cultural memory about what it means to be an American. And that's the grounds upon which I've been, you know, arguing for years. And, you know, obviously we haven't won any revolution lately, but at times we've surprised ourselves. How's that?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I'm going to make a really dumb kind of reference here, but if you watch something old, like if you go watch an old Andy Griffith episode,
yeah, right.
What you'll find is that in this all-American character, there's always a progressive edge. He's never the figure of just straightforward authority.
Yeah.
He's always the figure who's trying to struggle to work it out in his community and do right by people.
Yeah. Yeah, Indeed. Because why is the TV show like that? I mean, for all of its failings, we might have wanted it to be more. But why is it like that? It's because they operated within a certain set of, you know, sort of American norms and expectations, which, by the way, the larger world did not. I mean,
right? You know, it was reaching its audience is what it was doing.
You know, in that vein, I have to tell you this one thing, which is just I remember reading this and I was really astounded. You know, this is before your time, and I was a little boy when these shows were on. There was the Jack Benny show, radio and then television. And, you know, and on that show, he had maybe a butler, a driver, you know, the man about the house guy, Rochester.
A manservant.
A manservant, right? But what's interesting, and I didn't think about it as I was growing up, but on reflection, it made sense. So I was reading about Rochester, the actor who played that role, who, by the way, was a hero in the black community in Los Angeles. And why? Because Jack never had the upper hand. Rochester always revealed how his boss, his employer, was the fool. It was a kind of, in its own way, it was not unlike the medieval carnivalesque moment, you know. And, you know, so the trick is for us, you know, not to see things one-dimensionally, but to see the possibilities within them. And, you know, otherwise, what the fuck is the dialectic, right?
Right, exactly. So if we can just accept
that. By the way, I haven't talked in these terms in a long time. The F word I have, right. But not dialectic.
Dialectic. There's a real swear word on the left. Dialectic.
You bet. Well, you know what? Saying dialectic in some quarters is like saying trilateral commission in some quarters.
right. You might as well call me comrade. So here's what I want to say. I want to ask you because I feel as though we still have a long way to go to convincing ourselves, maybe not you. You don't have that long way to go, but I may have a little ways to go to convince myself that I can be an American leftist as an American. And that I don't have to, well, I mean, I really do think there's a strong anti-American sentiment in the American left.
Yeah. And by the way, and you know what? And that's something that as we do this book and it comes out, I think it's, I don't put it so strongly, but I think we have, even on the, in the mildest form, we see evidence of it. And let me give you an example of what I mean. I mean, look, I voted for Bernie Sanders here in Wisconsin in the primary. And by the way, he won the state of Wisconsin. And had he been the candidate for the Democratic Party, he probably would be our president now. But I've said that. OK. But the thing is that the one thing that really continually annoyed me and frustrated me, exasperated me about Bernie, and I think I've told you this before, is that he introduced, when he was explaining what democratic socialism was, he introduced FDR. He introduced, you know, Martin Luther King. He talked about these figures as members of the larger sort of social democratic. He used the terms democratic socialist intellectual tradition and political tradition. And that was great. But he did that once. And as soon as he then went back on the campaign trail, most of the time, and this came out especially in the primary debates with Hillary, he resorted to telling Americans, well, look what they do in Scandinavia, which enabled Hillary to say, well, we're not Denmark. Why did Bernie turn, if you like, run from the American story, which, by the way, Hillary did as well. The two of them shared in turning from the American story. They didn't make it a point ever of grabbing hold, or as we probably will title the book, taking hold of American history. Thomas Paine, you know, the Declaration. Let's bring it up through the feminists from, you know, Fanny Wright, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You know where I'm going. It's that kind of, I mean, I can give you the rundown, which all of which will be mentioned at least once or twice or three times in the book, of the degree to which what enables us, for you and I, to be talking, even in the age of Trump, in a liberal democratic fashion, are those struggles carried out from below and by radicals, many of whom were socialists, you know, in the late 19th century into the 20th. I mean, how do we think this happened? It didn't happen because capitalists decided to be more entertaining to have liberal democracy. It happened because people struggled for it.
And so you would have had him say, I'm a social democrat in the same way that I'm a democratic socialist in the same way that Thomas Paine was a democratic socialist.
It would be tough to call him a democratic socialist, at least a social democrat, because it was Thomas Paine originally who envisioned, laid out a plan for Social Security. Okay, he could have laid, I mean, here was Bernie Sanders, could have laid claim to Abraham Lincoln, who signed into law the Homestead Act, who signed into law the Morrill Act, the Land Grant Act that gave lands to states to underwrite the creation of public universities to enable opportunities for men and women to get degrees and not have to go off to the Ivy League colleges, you know, with the elites. He could have laid hold even of somebody I'm not as fond of, Teddy Roosevelt, but even more importantly, Eugene Debs, who is Bernie Sanders' hero. Or he could have come all the way up to Franklin Roosevelt, which he did do, but stick to the Roosevelt story, perhaps. I mean, I don't know.
Do you think it's because he figured that Sweden was more immediate for people than FDR?
No, absolutely not. In fact, look, most Americans couldn't give a damn about Sweden or Denmark or Norway. You know, I mean, they just couldn't. But I'll tell you what I think it is. I think here's what I think has happened. I think it's an element, perhaps, of political correctness. And it's this. We have spent so many years since the 60s recovering the fuller story of America's past to overcome the school book stories of the 1950s, okay? And in one sense, I don't think Howard Zinn's book is as great as all my friends on the left do, but Howard Zinn's book is a masterpiece of revealing the tragic side of American history. It's not a very happy story he tells, nor is it a very promising story he tells in that original edition. Well, I think people on the left, even if they haven't read Howard Zinn, like, say, of Hillary Clinton, I doubt she's read People's History. But I think these folks run from the American story because we've had so many years of a necessary kind of identity politics that the fear is that if you somehow grab hold of Thomas Jefferson, you will be accused of being a racist. That if you, in other words, I think that's what happens. This I'm very serious about. And I think, in essence, too many times liberals and the left run from the past rather than laying hold of the past. And by the way, by turning and running from the past, you're in essence doing worse damage to the story of the diversity of American life than if you had done so. And here's why. Because it isn't a story simply of exploitation and oppression. It's a story of slaves rising up, running away, doing everything they could to emancipate themselves. It's a story of working people who come to America believing in the promise of America and then organizing labor unions, fighting for their rights, demanding free speech for workers, pushing for industrial democracy. In other words, by failing to lay hold of the past, to take hold of the past, to lay claim to the past, we're in essence abandoning our own heritage.
Let's say you look back to someone like Malcolm X.
Okay.
Who said, I don't see how any self-respecting black man can fight for this country or respect this flag or feel pride in the moon landing or something like that.
I'm not an American. I'm one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are the victims of democracy. Nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American or a patriot or a flag saluter or a flag waver. No, not I. I'm speaking as a victim of this American system. And I see America through the eyes of a victim. I don't see any American dream. I see an American nightmare.
Well,
and I'll just say this, but I feel as though that has to be taken in as American, that like taking a knee is American, that trying to challenge what America stands for is American.
Yeah. Taking a knee, by the way, to take the knee, I thought, geez, how much more respect can you show the flag if you're trying to descend from the American order than to take the knee, which is not unlike kneeling down for prayer or being anointed or something like that. Yeah, just for the point. But I don't think Malcolm X has ever spoken for the majority of African Americans, by the way, and I want to make that clear. And I think that's evident in everything from the struggles during the Revolution, where African Americans both ran to the British with the promise of freedom, but also up north, free blacks and even those who've been slaves enlisted in the American Army on the belief that they were going to secure a land of you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The fact that they got screwed so much didn't keep later African American intellectuals and radicals from laying hold to that same promise. I mean, the fight goes on. I mean, it just goes on.
I've been debating Michael Brooks a little bit, not on the air, but just in private, about the Trump election. Now, it's more that he's been bringing this up to me than the other way around. But
are we talking 2016 or 2018?
2016. Yeah. People like Adolph Reed, and I think a lot of people who are supporting Bernie Sanders still and would like to see him run again, are fairly convinced that what cost Hillary Clinton the election was economic insecurity, specifically in the Rust Belt, in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, and that the Trump voters were not necessarily motivated by racist demagoguery, or not alone. But they were also motivated by a sense of precarity and a desire for their jobs to return, perhaps. And that it was in some ways an indictment of the policies of the last 8 years that someone like Trump could come along and make false promises to those people and get their votes.
Yeah,
that's a sort of one way this is being spun. But since then, a lot of information has come in that they've you know, done surveys and polling and things like that. And a great many, by far the majority of the people who voted for Trump were feeling what might be better characterized as white anxiety or racial anxiety rather than economic anxiety, that they were worried about their status. There's this debate between, well, what mattered? Was it a matter of a loss of status that people were worried about? Were they trying to hold on to white power as white power? Mm-hmm. Or was it economically motivated? I don't think that those two things are that easy to separate.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I agree with you. I don't think that – I actually think that it would be a mistake to separate them. And can I – should I start answering or – okay. Yeah, let me put it this way. Let's start with this reality, right, and which I referred to earlier. So 45 years of class war against working people. By the way, class struggle has always been the case. That's another story. But class war, especially in the wake of the, you know, I can name the things. The Powell Memorandum is like a high point of that time. A speech by David Rockefeller was even earlier, I believe, than the Powell Memorandum, which said the same thing. The Trilateral Commission basically laid out an array of forces that needed to be tempered, dampened, suppressed. Poor people's movement, women's demands, student demands, professors, workers. I mean, right? I mean, it was all there in black and white in books. The NYU Press published the Trilateral Commission report. It was all there in the mid-70s, right? The powers that be, corporate powers that be, and conservatives, both Democratic and Republican, feared the possibility that the diverse movements that had emerged, including and very fundamentally workers' anger in the 60s, which a lot of people forget, that was all going to coalesce into a broad left progressive movement in the course of the 70s. They had no doubt about it, okay? Now, so we've got 45 years of this. And one of the things that people realize is if you want to defeat your enemy, divide your enemy. Divide him. Here in Wisconsin, Scott Walker was able to triumph over the labor movement, first of all, by portraying public employees as the problem of the state, the wages that we were receiving, the powers that we supposedly had, all that kind of stuff, to the point where he drove a wedge between private sector unions and public sector unions, and they passed Act 10, which took away collective bargaining rights for public employees in the state of Wisconsin. And the state of Wisconsin was the first state ever to grant public employees the right to collectively bargain back in 1959. So here's the deal. Once you've wiped out public employees' collective bargaining rights, then they turn around and within a couple of years, we became a right-to-work state, a state of Wisconsin, right? A right-to-work state. So now similarly, how's this? Similarly, Walker and the Republicans passed a voter ID kind of law here in the state, which went through a whole series of court things. And it got to the point where no one knew if you were supposed to have an ID or not. The point was confusion reigned, okay? Nevertheless, Obama won two times. He was elected, right? And by the way, voter suppression was not only directed against the African-American community and the poor, but also against students. Which, by the way, in Wisconsin was a sizable figure. Okay, so here's what happens. So in 2016, Hillary's running in Wisconsin. I can only use my own state as a prime example of what happened. Hillary Clinton, and I could tell the story and I won't tell it right now. Hillary Clinton decided not to return to Wisconsin to campaign, even though Bernie Sanders had beaten her in Wisconsin. Did not come back once to campaign in the state. Now, maybe if she'd come back, people would have said then she at least that she might care a bit. How's that, first of all? Second of all, in Wisconsin, not only did working people in a generic kind of sense give their votes to Donald Trump, so too did middle class, and I'm sure most of the elite did, screw working people. But it's also this. African Americans didn't turn out to vote for Hillary in the way that they would turned out for Barack Obama. And the city of Milwaukee was basically written off as well. So I assume similar story could be told in maybe Michigan and Pennsylvania. And she still won, by the way, with 3 million more votes nationally. But the fact is that, yeah, people were pissed because of, look, do I need to I can happily review the Clintons' attack on working people too in the 19, by the way, attack on working people, white, black, and brown, right? Okay. Welfare reform, mass incarceration, and the failure to do anything to strengthen workers' rights. I mean, and by the way, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. No, exactly. No. I mean, look, I always say to my students, Carter, Clinton, Obama. Okay. What have we got? Did you see anybody fighting for workers' rights in the course of that? No. Okay. I mean, so what I'm getting at is, yeah. So working people, white and black, had reason to doubt. Now, for the case of white workers, well, they're angry enough to vote for Trump. In the case of black workers, well, they'd have had to been out of their minds perhaps to do so. So they turned out in fewer numbers. I mean, I don't think it's so hard to make sense of all that. And I don't think, but let me also add this. When Trump campaigned, he campaigned as a race. I mean, the guy was a racist. It was evident. Okay. And it becomes ever more evident. So the more he could divide people, because he couldn't possibly win by bringing them together, okay? The Republicans then really would have been pissed off with him. So the thing is that where was the left? It doesn't pay to decry it. For 40 years, we have failed to mobilize solidarities. And neoliberalism did anything but cultivate solidarities.
This whole debate about whether it was status anxiety or economic anxiety is asking a question about what we do politically to try to win. But it's also sort of replacing that question with the question of what are we morally obligated to do. And I think secretly in there, there's this sort of moral obligation to remain divided. If you believe that the mass of men and women in rural America are just racist.
Yeah, but they're not. I mean, they're not irredeemable racists. And the fact is that look, I mean, we live in these myths. And one of the myths, for example, is that it was working people who supported the war in Vietnam back in the 60s, that supported the war in Vietnam. Okay. And all the enlightened middle classes opposed it. Well, the fact is that most working people opposed it as well. But their kids were in the army. And what they didn't like was that people were somehow showing sympathy and solidarity with the enemy. I mean, it was a myth that working people, favored the war. It just wasn't true. They favored. That's why this whole question of support the troops may actually, you know, would have worked better back then than it would have worked now, because now we're in these wars anyhow.
We have a tough political challenge ahead of us to try to unite all these different factions that are really part of the same tradition on the left around an American tradition here, you know, and a European tradition in Europe, an African tradition in Africa, but nonetheless a socialist tradition. You know, it's going to mean having some squabbles and working out what the meanings of events are. And I think we just can't avoid the fact that it would be better off if we'd been pushing harder to struggle for working people of all colors in the last 40 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing we have to remember. It's like one of the shames of language is that we try to be encompassing. That's not the shame of language, but when we try to be encompassing, we talk about, let's see, workers' rights, women's rights, and we used to say minority rights, the rights of people of color. Most often we were talking about African Americans' rights. But when we say working people's, we shouldn't assume that that's white. And I know that sounds obvious, but we really shouldn't. The labor movement is a far more diverse movement than it has ever been in American history. And I belong to two unions, and I can only hope that labor finds it within itself, perhaps, and we'll talk about this more and more, I hope, in the months ahead, you and I, that labor could step forward and become the dynamic force in bringing together the new solidarities, which will involve, I hate to say this word, it's going to involve articulations, it's going to involve solidarities, and it's going to involve certain kinds of compromises in favor of a strategy and tactics to advance.